We'll start by talking about paging, because paging is a very interesting service involving classically a very small number of bits. And the most important thing about pagers were the fact that they could sleep most of the time. That means you could have a pager and literally have it run for a month and not have to worry about the battery power. But it means that it spends nearly all of its time sleeping. Now, in North America, there were two-way paging systems, and thus the pagers could both send and receive traffic. Unfortunately, in much of Europe, until very much later, the systems were only one way. You could only send pages out. And as I was just talking to a student at the break, knowing that people receive the page, getting back an acknowledgement, is a very important thing. And if you don't have a channel over which you can send the acknowledgement, you don't know whether they received it or not. Now, I mentioned a little bit earlier specialized mobile radio systems for taxi, fleet dispatching, etc. And we discussed this is the basis for Nextel. And one of the interesting features that Nextel incorporated was, since they were replacing these taxi dispatching and fleet dispatching sorts of services, was a walkie-talkie-like service. So what's a walkie-talkie? Push to talk, right? So I push the button and I can talk. When I let go of the button, I stop transmitting. Now it turns out that a neat feature of this was just what these people in taxis, trucks, and so forth wanted, right? There are 5 more people here at Arlanda. Send some more cars, right? Let go of the button. But it also turns out that because those are typically short talk spurts, you can actually start to treat it like packetized communication and forward the packetized traffic. Also, most of the traffic is all local. So Nextel, when they introduced this service, said not only, hey, you sell us these frequencies, but instead of us paying you money, we'll actually give you new handsets that will operate, and therefore we'll only pay you a little bit of money for your radio frequencies. And the company said, hey, yes, we don't have to keep paying for, and the previous systems for this were rather expensive. But additionally, they said to their customers, all of their customers, if you want to use this sort of service, we'll give you, 5,000 minutes per month, free. You just get your subscription, and it will include 5,000 minutes per month of this switch-to-talk mode. Yes, very, very successful. Later, push-to-talk over cellular has become an important service, but it came much, much later. We mentioned LEO satellites, and LEO satellites are low Earth orbit satellites, and there have been lots of attempts to be able to build these systems. The basic problem is most of the world is oceans, right? So the problem is that your satellites, which are very expensive, since they're at low Earth orbit, pass over you very quickly, perhaps 10 minutes or so one satellite is in view. So there have to be frequent handoffs. And most of the places in the world are water. So most of your assets are covering places where there are no customers. A problem. They have relatively low orbits. Interestingly enough, the U.S. Department of Defense has a system called the Enhanced Mobile Satellite Service. And the last I heard, they have 250,000 users using these handsets. And the reason was that, in fact, they have people out in places where there aren't lots of other people, and they need communication. And it turns out this system works everywhere in the world, even at the poles. So the Nordic Polar Expedition Group and Antarctic Group actually use these satellite systems to communicate from their sensors that they have on the ground at the North and South Poles region. And about a year and a half ago, I had 2 students And they both did their X job looking at using these systems out in the forest of Sweden, because the father of one of them, her family, grow trees. They're tree farmers. And her father does harvesting both of their own forest and harvesting of other people's forests. And harvesting trees is a very, very important business here in Sweden. And there are two huge, incredibly expensive machines that go out into the forest. One of them grabs the tree, cuts it off, turns it down, cuts the branches off. The other one comes along, picks the tree up, cuts it into pieces, stacks it, and then those are loaded on and then taken off to the mill where they're made into pulp and paper or into wood. Now, the interesting thing is the tree first machine that cuts the trees is going along picking out particular trees, cutting them off, and it's geolocation tagging the information about that particular tree. They know the kind of the tree, how big the tree is, the diameter, the length, and all of that. It takes those with that data record with a GPS coordinate of where it cut down the tree and where it stacked it, and passes them to the other machine, which is somewhere else. Now, why don't they just have one machine follow the other one? Anyone know? Because there's a spot market. Yes. There are orders that come out from the mills every day saying, I want to buy 100 million board meters, or I guess they would be board meters of birch today. Okay? And there's a price for that. And mill basically advertises the price for a certain kind of wood. So the first machine that's going around is cutting them because they're mature, etc., and have value. The other one is picking them up in just the right order to send them to the mill to fill the orders because they get the best price for that particular kind of wood that day. There's enormous amounts of money at stake here, and this is one of Sweden's biggest businesses. The hard problem is, since the vehicles are out in the forest, yes, how do they communicate? So does anyone know classically how they communicated? The standard system used in Sweden? It's really very clever. The tractor unit uploads to the person's GSM phone using short-range radio, so Bluetooth. When that person leaves the forest and goes into town to feed their family, party, whatever, it uploads it when they reach town. So when the phone senses it has cellular coverage again, they upload that data. When the guy or girl who's driving around the loader is in town, the infrastructure says, hey, here's a list of trees to go and pick up. And so when they go back out into the forest, they know where they should go and pick up the tree. Now, is this very real time? No. It's average of something like 5 days between when the data is produced to when it gets to the other person. It's a very long latency network. Right? But it had to be done because there wasn't a GSM system out in the forest. But by using satellite systems, they could immediately send that data, and so they could actually optimize what they were doing that day. And the fascinating thing is these two young women showed that their system not only had lower delays, but was actually cheaper. There are also wideband systems, wideband CDMA, CDMA 2000, and the Chinese standard that was just recently accepted called TD, SCDMA, and you can go and read about it. The problem is, although most of these systems use the same CDMA technology, the code division multiple access, the problem is they're incompatible. And even worse is that the 3GPP group, the third generation partnership project, manages the evolution of GSM. They've produced these standards. The third generation Partnership Project 2, 3GPP2, they manage this set of standards, and one can presume that there'll be another group called probably 3GPPP3 or something like that that'll manage the Chinese 3G standard. They go off in very different directions. However, at least these two groups have tried to harmonize some of the things because they also need the advantages of volume manufacturing. However, the handsets and the radio systems are fundamentally incompatible. There's also local metropolitan area networks, typically point-to-point or point-to-multipoint, and there have been operators with as much as 700 megahertz of spectrum, in the case of one operator that I advised in the U.S., nationwide, and they failed horribly. The range of these systems were typically just a few kilometers, and the data rates were tens of megabits to a gigabit per second or more. One of the hard problems here, and why this particular firm failed badly, is there weren't enough of these, they were too expensive, and they needed an engineer to set them up. What's the problem with that? Well, as an operator, it means the fastest that you can install is proportional to the number of engineers that you have. Okay? This is a big disadvantage, right? You contrast that with wireless LAN, where, as I say, you get it, the package in the mail, or you pick it up at the local candy store, you take it home, you open the box, throw the manual away, plug it in, and turn it on, right? You laugh, but this problem about only being able to install things at the proportional to the number of engineers that you have meant they couldn't make enough money. They had spectrum, they had no problems for spectrum, they couldn't get enough engineers. And what they were selling was quickly being able to provide point-to-point connectivity or point-to-multipoint connectivity, typically in urban areas, where your branch office wants to talk to this other branch office and you want it today. Right? Because if you wanted it next quarter, you'd go to the telephone company to get it, right? So the advantage was supposed to be the speed of installing a high bandwidth link. But if you couldn't provide that speed advantage, well, too bad. That's changing a bit now with the introduction of a new technology, which we will talk about more later. People have also tried to do that with point-to-point optical links. And here the advantage was companies like Free Space Optics said, hey, in many countries, I don't need a license to be able to point a light source at a detector over there. I can just put it up. Right? So now we don't need radio engineers. Sorry for those of you who studied radio engineering. We don't need those radio engineers to set it up anymore. We just need somebody who can point an A. Sounds really good. These systems supported very high data rates and reasonable ranges. What's the big problem? Why haven't they been so successful? Right? You know, lasers work at really amazingly well over long distances, right? Where's the problem? We can have very, very sensitive photodetectors.
They are fragile.
Why are they fragile? Okay, so a bird flies in this beam, boom, the beam is broken, right? We get nothing. All right? The same thing happens when it snows, rains, etc. So we can have problems then. But of course the little droplets come down and yes, there are interruptions, but if we have a high enough data rate and the right protocols on top of it, maybe it's not such a big problem. It turns out one of the hard problems is if I mount this laser on a little tripod on the top of the building, buildings sway and move, particularly tall buildings. Even relatively small buildings, yes, shrink and expand as they heat and cool down. So the problem is it isn't just pointed roughly in that direction. I need to have it actually hitting my very small little detector on the other end. Okay? Any of you study optics? Right? There's a real simple solution. We put a lens in front of this detector, and now if you hit anywhere on the lens, as it focuses it on the detector. But what happens now to our cost? Yes, our cost just went up a lot. Because now we need really big lenses, right? Or we could say, oh, no, we micromechanically position it. We change actually where the thing is pointing. And so we have little servo motors and we track it and do all, now we've just made it much more complex. Right? So we either had expensive optics or we had lots of mechanical complexity. Both of these killed it so far in comparison to radio, where, gee, if I sort of get it in the right general direction, it works. All right? But there could be something someday there. Wireless local area networks initially supported both fast frequency hopping, direct sequence spread spectrum, and nowadays orthogonal frequency division multiplexing, and there were even some IR links. An important feature of many of the earlier wireless LAN systems were that they used the so-called instrumentation, scientific, and medical bands, the ISM bands. In North America, they were also able to operate in the National Information Infrastructure band, and in Europe, in the Hyperlan band. Why was this so important? Well, the advantage was that they were secondary users of these bands, which by and large were considered by most people junk, because in this band is where you had things like diathermy machines doing heating using radio waves. There was just interference all over the place. Microwave ovens run in this band, et cetera, et cetera. No one, except for one other industry, which is, if you've heard of a company called LoJack for car tracking. Yes, car tracking also uses the same band. So wireless LAN came into this band as the third priority users. And it was already considered junk to begin with, which is why they were allowed to become the third users. But the advantage was the user does not have to have a radio license. Okay, the manufacturer has to make the wireless LAN radio so that it meets certain requirements. But then the user doesn't have to have a license. Yes, it radically changed things because now anyone could buy one of these things, go into a shop, take it out with them, and use it. Okay? Whereas before, to be able to get radio equipment, what did you have to have? Yes, a license. And not only a license, usually you had to have an operator's license. So the human who was using that equipment had to be a licensed radio operator. Okay? This removal of the requirement to have licenses meant that this spread enormously. Data rates, hundreds of kilobits to 54 kilobits to now more than 100 megabits per second, largely standardized in the IEEE 802.11 standards. And the nice thing is you can go and download them all after they're a certain age. It's an excellent set of documentation. And short-range radio, things like RFID tags, near-field communications, etc. So for those of you who have your, you know, RFID SL card, right, when you hold it over the thing, it says, aha, yes, you're a valid user, you have this kind of subscription, go ahead. Companies like Nokia are starting to put in near-field communication in these same frequencies, so when you hold this near-field communications radio on top of it, can say, aha, I'm in Stockholm. Ah, load in an SL card, look like an SL card, right? Or, gee, I take it with me to Helsinki, and, oh, the phone is in Helsinki, it looks like a Helsinki transit card, right? So instead of carrying a pocket full of different transit cards, I can have this thing virtually be it. There are going to be some really interesting things happening in this area. I mentioned ultra wideband takes advantage of the fact that producing pulses is very easy, right? I just have a switch that turns on and emits. And for those of you who remember radio history, that was how Marconi originally did communication with spark gaps, right? And these sparks pulsing produced an extremely wideband radio signal. Now, why weren't they used? Well, because they interfered with everything. Right? Well, these systems today, it's possible to actually do sufficient filtering for them so that the band that the signal's in is both extremely wide and not overlapping with other frequencies, and the range is relatively short, but the result is people showed that they could get very, very high data rates at extreme low power. So today people are looking at this to be able to do things like send uncompressed video from one device to another. If we look at this range, with near field down here at sort of millimeter through personal area networks, local area networks, metropolitan area networks, wide area networks, regional, planetary, interplanetary, and intergalactic, we can see there's a very, very wide range of communication ranges. And you might say, of course, why do these matter to us? Well, for those of you who study delay-tolerant networks, that's what you have to use when you start to have these very, very long delays. But the most important thing for us is the fact this implies that solutions are going to be heterogeneous, because there are different kinds of radios and different kinds of technologies used for this whole range of things. One solution isn't enough. So as I said, are interplanetary and intergalactic things of interest to us? Well, yes, because some of the technologies, like delay-tolerant networks, change the way we think about communication. Right? In particular, we're seeing an evolution from interactive conversational communication to transference of content. Okay? So I don't stream you an MP3, I simply blast the bits of the MP3 to you, and you play them out at the rate you want to hear them. Okay? A big change from broadcasting radio, where the rate at which you transmitted was the rate at which you consumed. Just like conversational audio, the rate at which one speaker speaks has to be adjusted to the rate at which the other user can listen. We can break that model. In addition, there's the issue about communications over time. And in particular, we need to make sure that it's uncorrupted for very long periods of time. You might say, well, why is that important for us when we think about communication systems? So how do you know that what you're hearing is what I'm saying now? Right? You guess it because you see my lips moving, and at the right time later, you hear it. But he's got his voice recorder up here, and later, of course, you could listen to that audio and hear the same things being said, but now you don't see the lips moving. How do you know it was me saying that? Okay, and issues about that and the integrity of communications are becoming very important. So a year ago, I was giving a lecture in the National Library in Vienna, and Austria has introduced a goal of being able to preserve digital documents, records, etc., for 200 years, longer than any of the media is going to be preserved. In fact, longer than even digital signatures may remain valid. So how can you know in 200 years that if I digitally sign that digital recording, that the signature is correct when people have figured out how to break MD5 signed hashes already today? Okay? So these are going to start to become very interesting to us as we move from purely interactive communication to communication of whole content over time. How can we deal with all these? Well, we could look for a single winner, ATM, UMTS, whatever, or we could say, aha, we have a single networking protocol, IP, ITX, SNA, whatever, or we could live with multiple winners. And this has been the model in the past. Most of these efforts at single architectures have failed, but so far IP is doing rather well providing a uniform protocol, and of course, not surprisingly, that's why we have internetworked architectures today. So we can interconnect our cellular network via interworking units. We can go through a wide area network to token rings, FDDI, wired LANs, wireless LANs, etc. Okay? Because we have integrated it by having a common internetworking protocol. In addition, it's very common we need to attach to the PSTN. And so attaching to the PSTN means we need to have some gateways to be able to do that. And We'll see examples of that later. We're going to talk about cellular networks, why those local area networks. We'll also talk about ad hoc networks. Anyone here who studies Latin? What does ad hoc mean? It means for the purpose. Okay? So we build a network here simply because there are a whole bunch of devices that are near each other and want to communicate. Okay? There's no infrastructure. Just communicating devices. We can even think about personal area networks, where I have a device that's, you know, a smart button on my jacket that wants to communicate to the biosensor that's in my wristwatch that wants to put the data up to my heads-up display. Okay? These are personal area networks, and they're becoming very important today. So anyone here from Finland? If you like outdoor exercise, there's a company, Polar Boy, that has this marvelous system for measuring your breathing, measuring your pulse rate, all of those sorts of things, so that you can train at the absolute maximum point that you can function before you die. All of these things communicate wirelessly. And a student did a thesis last year saying, take that data, pass it via a wide area network back to the coach who's sitting in a nice, warm, heated hut, who's able to say, aha, harder, yes, Olaf, faster up the hill, right? So, internetworking becomes really important. How do you put these systems together? And the common way of doing that is to use a common network layer. But a hard problem has been that the telephony system internetworked things previously by forcing everything to have the same fixed rate, which was 64 kilobits per second. So if you make a call from Sweden to the US, what has to happen? Anyone know? Well, in Sweden, the communication rate of the basic communication channel is 64 kilobits per second. What's the matching rate in North America? 56 kilobits per second. Even though they're both sampling audio at 8 kilosamples per second, the problem is North American systems steal some of those bits for control purposes, and therefore the data rate's only 56 kilobits per second. So to connect those two together, we can't just connect the lines. We actually have to have an interworking unit there to translate from one to the other. The problem is, however, that this tended to freeze in the quality. Telephone quality on the fixed network hasn't changed. The interconnections raise a lot of technical, political, and regulatory effects, and I suspect we're going to see the rise of truly international operators sort of doing what Vodafone and others have tried to do, to say we have a logical single network, even though they're physically separate networks, by integrating them. Now, all of you, since you're supposed to have had internetworking, know about the open architectural model, the end-to-end argument, and hourglass model. Anyone who doesn't remember this? Okay, fine. How did this avoid the problem of broadband ISDN? Well, the idea of interconnecting networks by common link layer protocol is clear. We need to be able to somehow integrate ourselves together. We want lots of vendors and products because that means we have good competition and a fast development and deployment cycle. But an important issue is really having the technology be just good enough. It doesn't have to be perfect. And this is an important change. And Clayton Christensen in the book, The Innovator's Dilemma, when new technologies cause great firms to fail, looks at this problem of what happens when you have very well-developed technologies and a new competitor comes along, and it's very different. And everyone says, ugh, horrible. Voice quality is horrible, the delays are bad, and they point to all these problems to it. It'll never amount to anything. And that's, of course, what the telephony people said about the internet. Right? The problem is that technology advances potentially very rapidly. The other technology is frozen in stone, and it has a problem. But this change means we have both increased cooperation and competition. But today, networks are basically becoming commodities, and people have to differentiate themselves, it's believed, by offering different services. So let's take a look at an example of internetworking. Here we have a user who's going to receive an SMS. So here we have a GSM network, here's a mobile station, and here we have a device that takes AT commands, a web browser over here, communicates via TCP/IP network to a server here, which passes these messages and sends them across this link. That's one way that we could send things from our internet device to this mobile user. Another way, of course, is we could send them into the operator's central exchange, their SMS switching center, and they could send them out as SMSs across their normal network. What's the difference between these two? Right, they both have to have a gateway. Why would you ever think about building one of these gateways? So for the guy who's talking to us, the break. Why would you go this direction and not that direction? Well, the problem is the operator controls all of this. So when you send your messages in, the operator can forward these SMSs when it's convenient for the operator to send them. Right? Whereas if you send them this way, you get to decide when you're going to send them. Okay? But what's the difference in impact on the network? Well, in this first one, the problem is you don't get to send it directly to the receiving terminal. In fact, what you actually have to do is you send it, it goes into the operator's network, and they send it back out. So it actually goes over the air twice. In this model, it only goes over the air once. The operators love this model. Right? But a hard problem is that because they're optimizing things for themselves, the delay through this network might be very, very high. So a number of years ago, there was a company here in Stockholm saying, hey, it would be really great. I have my phone here. I'm at the checkout counter at Megasweep. And I say, okay, I want to buy these CDs. Okay, I'm going to transfer the money from my account to you via sending an SMS to do it. Sounded like a great idea. Why didn't it work well? Well, because the delay through here could be as much as more than 15 minutes. So in the case of CellTribe, I had some students who measured it, and the result was that not only was there a large peak around 15 minutes, but the tail was more than 24 hours long. So I can see the person standing there and they're like, just wait a moment, I'm going to pay. If it has a long delivery time, it doesn't work for that service. And in this model, it had long delay times. But in this model, because you could control, it has to be sent now, because that's when the handset's trying to send it, yes, you could have lower delays. Data rates. GSM, when it was initially introduced, had a 14.4 kilobit per second per channel rate. Somebody said, that's not fast enough, what can we do? Well, if one channel is not fast enough, what do? Well, you put several of them together. And so I saw one demonstration at Bern Salon where they had eight handsets duct taped together to combine the eight channels together, and they're actually able to send low data rate video across that. The operator came back and said, oh, what we could do is we could logically do that, and we could just logically combine several channels together and have the handset transmit in multiple time slots. Then GPRS was introduced because the problem is in packet-oriented mode, we're typically not sending continuously. The problem in both of these modes is we set up circuits. Whether we're sending any data or not, we have to pay. So this radically changed things. And then, of course, wireless LAN systems came in, wireless PANs, metropolitan area networks, and then, of course, MobiFi
80.20, so broadband wireless access, rendering all those lower data rate systems essentially irrelevant. Now the trends are we're moving from circuit switch to packet switch because we make better use of the resources. We only send data when we have to send it. We're using technologies like voice over IP on top of this packet switch network. Number portability, we'll see, is a very important issue. Why would number portability be so important? Right, it's very hard to switch from one operator to another if you have to give up your telephone number and tell all of your friends your new phone number, right? Unless you're a drug dealer, terrorist, or something like that, and you want to make it difficult to be found, right? Well, actually, maybe for a drug dealer, it's also a bad thing because your customers can't find you. Actually, that was one of the most important uses of pagers. So the problem here is it's about how do I go from this name or label for a user to the device that the user is carrying. And we'll see that that's an important problem, and if you have numbers, you'd really like to be able to have the number associated with the person, not simply with the device and not bound to a single operator. Today, an important area of services are so-called context-aware services. These services may be, for instance, location-aware. So as we gave the example earlier, my handset could download the right transit card for Stockholm and a different one when I'm in Paris and a different one in London, a different one in Helsinki, right? And automatically do that for me. Now, how many of you have ever seen people at, usually at airports, and they pull out this little folder and it opens up and there's row after row of SIM cards there, right? And so they play the SIM card shuffle. Because when they get to the airport, they say, okay, I'm in Stockholm now, get out the Stockholm SIM card, put it in. And I take out my Mumbai SIM card and I put it back in the folder. Why are they doing that? Well, by having SIM cards that are in the location where they are, they often get cheaper rates. Right? So what's the problem in this? Yes, the user has 20 different phone numbers, right? And you have to try them in different phone numbers because of the difference in the SIM cards they're using. Is there a reason to do this today? No, we could all do that in software, and yet I haven't seen yet a company do it. So this automatic context awareness, adapting the device and services for where the user is and what they're trying to do. A big change is that traditionally only telecom operators could offer service. Today, anybody can offer a service, right? In most cases today, let's say at least in a smartphone, I've got a web browser, right? So as long as I can get connectivity off to the web server, anything that I can build on that infrastructure, boom, I can field it today. Whereas if I had to get the telecom operator, which usually means the telecom vendors had to build it in, what was the time it took to roll out a service? 5 to 10 years, right? Very little innovation is going to happen that way. There are a lot of efforts to retain control, market share, high profit, access to dialed numbers, call contents, etc. But the problem is it's difficult to get the genie to go back in the bottle. Now, another important change is that classically we have evolved in generations. We have the first generation cellular systems with analog, the second generation GSM systems, then the third generation. But we're moving away from that. Now, Theo Kantor, one of my former doctoral students, calls these new systems PiG systems, right? Now, why is that supposed to be humorous? Well, we know, of course, pi is between 3 and 4. And most importantly, it's an irrational number, right? It's not going to be a 3G system or 4G system. It's going to be something in between. And we don't know where that is yet today. We don't know that there's going to be a fourth generation that everyone will agree upon. There are going to be a bunch of systems. Now, there's an excellent book, which I can hardly recommend to anyone who's interested in internet technology. It's called The Future of the Internet, and how to stop it. And it's by Jonathan Zittrain. And he's very, very interesting because he points out to the difference of what he calls generational or generative systems or technologies. And the internet and the PC were both generative technologies. They enabled high leverage, high adaptability, they were easy to master, the tools were readily accessible, and there was high transferability. That means an investment in producing something for a PC or the internet had a big impact because there were lots of other users who could build upon it. So very fast multiplying effects. Today, people are trying to take much of this technology and in some ways bound it so that it only behaves a certain way. So for instance, lots of IPTV set-top boxes are actually running Linux inside them. Right? The problem is, who controls the software that's loaded in the set-top box? You, the customer? No. Your operator. Now, why is this a problem? Well, there's a court case some time ago in the U.S., and a company ended up with the judge deciding that the technology that they had used in their personal video recorder infringed upon the patent of someone else. The judge ordered them to remove that functionality from all of these devices they had already sold. Now, how were they going to do that? Well, today it's possible because all of those devices regularly, yes, they phoned home and said, hey, is there new software for me? Oh, there's a new version of the software. Download the software. Yes. And the new version of the software took out the offending bits that the judge had ordered they couldn't have anymore. So all of these devices downgraded themselves. Yes, automatically. Right. Customers were not happy about this. All right. So a problem here is the fact that this is broken. Right? Suddenly you can have external control that decides, no, I don't like those bits that you're storing on your home personal video recorder. I'm going to delete them. Right? So there's a problem in there. And you can read more about it. So let's look at the basic architecture. We've got some radio network, some sort of base station, a base station controller that controls these different devices, some mobile stations. These base stations are typically attached to some mobile switching center, and then we have a mobility database so that we know, should we send the call if it comes in via this network to here, or should we send it to there? Right? They're all the basic bits and pieces. So they say the devil's in the details. So, for example, this works for a cordless system. So we could have a single cell attached to a base station and a cordless telephone here. We could attach it by a system such as GSM from the PSTN, the mobile switching station. Now we could have very large cells and many of them. Okay, so we see the two systems are very, very similar. In fact, the only major difference between here and here is what? It's these other little boxes. This home location register, visitor location register. This is so I know, aha, it is one of my users, or it's a visiting user from some other cellular network, and I'm going to provide service to them. And of course, I'm going to build them and all of those other sorts of things. But in fact, if we added that sort of functionality over here, yes, we get what Personal Handyphone achieved, which is mobility across between different users' home cordless base stations. Of course, we can put these systems together, and that's, of course, why we have this visitor location registry. So now we can take one operator's network and interconnect it to another operator's network and have users move from one to the other. Pretty straightforward. So, mobility management, if we look at the case of if mobiles only originate calls, you don't have to do mobility management. Right? We don't care where the phone is, because when it originates the call, it's going to go and say, hey, I hear a base station, give me connectivity. The problem is, if we want to be able to receive calls, then somehow we have to know where the phone is. And that means we either need a server in the network, or a server attached to the network, or a server attached to another network. In addition, if we're going to really support physical mobility, we may need to update this dynamically as we do the handoffs. And one of the techniques that's to use is paging. And we'll come back after lunch when we meet this afternoon, and we'll talk about some of the details of handoff and paging and how all of this works when we talk about mobility management protocols. So, any questions? Everyone's just in shock. Okay. If not, have a good lunch. See you this afternoon.